The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Welcome. My name is Andrea, for those of you that I've not met before. Earlier this week, I gave the talk on Sunday morning, and just as a part of the talk, kind of in passing, I mentioned the Buddhist teaching on not-self and said a few words about it, but that wasn't my topic, so I kind of said, okay, we'll put that on hold. And there wasn't time for questions at the end, and somebody dropped a question into the Donna box about not-self. And so I thought I would speak to that topic tonight, and I'll read the question in a little bit because I'm not sure the question will make too much sense until I get a little further into the talk. So this teaching, this topic, not self, is a it's a topic that sometimes creates a little bit of like gripping in the mind, or because there's the sense of self, this feeling, it just feels so normal and ordinary to have this sense of I am, and I'm walking through the world, and of course I'm a self. How can I not be a self? So just hearing that the Buddha said that this understanding of not self is a kind of a key understanding that helps to free the mind. Many of us kind of get all kind of hung up in our thoughts about, well, what is this teaching of not self? How can I understand it? And it's not always so easy to understand. There are ways that we can talk about it to help kind of shake up our usual ways that we think about a sense of self. And yet to really see into what the Buddha is pointing to, it's a very, it's kind of a slow process, and it's a deep pointing that he's pointing to. So I'll speak to some of the teachings the Buddha offered and kind of explore some of my own understanding of this teaching and just kind of go at a pretty high level today so that hopefully it won't feel too overwhelming. There's one place in the suttas, and I'll actually read a few of the words of the Buddha because some of these are kind of fun. In one place, he talks about the way that we relate to experience is so much through this sense of I, me, mine. And when we look at our thoughts, when we start thinking, looking at what's going on in our mind, those thoughts in our mind, how many of them have the word I in them? Almost all of them. I or me, It's like everything's about me. Who I am, where I am, what I am, in some flavor or fashion. And so the Buddha pointed to this, that to this kind of way that we tend to connect with the world. And he said, so an ordinary person basically doesn't quite understand how to pay attention. He says an ordinary person doesn't understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. And since that's the case, they attend to those things unfit for attention and do not attend to those things fit for attention. This is how they attend unwisely, and this will probably sound familiar. This is how they attend unwisely. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else they are inwardly perplexed about the present thus. Am I? Am I not? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? And this kind of reflection, this is basically how we tend to relate to our experience. Pretty much all of our experience comes back to me, to I, how I am in relationship to this. They did that to me. I need to fix that. I need to do that. It's all about me. And the Buddha points to this as being kind of a way that we are kind of skimming the surface. We could say we're skimming the surface of experience and not really connecting with what is actually happening. We're thinking about things in terms of how it relates to me instead of being curious about what is this experience? What actually is happening here? And so based on these, this way of connecting to experience, the Buddha says that this view of self, a sense of me, a sense of I as being, let's say, a thing that's traveling through space and time, that's often how we think of a sense of self, is that there is, and that's kind of what it feels like intuitively, that there's something stable traveling through space and time. And that, he points to that's basically an incorrect view of what's actually going on. And he pointed also to that particular view that I am a being going through space and time is very connected with the ways that we struggle in our lives. I'm not sure I'll be able to pull all of those pieces together, but we'll make some attempts here. So the Buddha pointed to this kind of orientation of I, me, mine as something that's kind of keeping us skimming the surface and not letting us really connect with what's actually going on. It's like we're living in a view of the way things are instead of what's actually happening, kind of below the level of concepts and views. And then he also pointed to conversation, and this is the last. Well, there may be one more sutta excerpt after this, but this he's having a conversation with someone. And this person is asking him the kind of question that we might ask, he says to the Buddha, who feels experience? And the Buddha responds, that's not a valid question. That's not the way to ask the question. I do not say that one feels. If I were to say that one feels, then that would be a valid question. But instead, perhaps you could ask the question, with what as condition does feeling come to be? This would be a valid question. And so this points to something very important about our misconception about our experience and a little bit about how we misattribute a sense of self. It's like the person's asking, who feels? And the Buddha says, the who part of that question is not really relevant or necessary. But there is a more useful question to ask, that's what are the conditions where feeling happens? And he says, with contact as condition, contact with the sense base. So contact with sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, a feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral comes to be. And so this is a kind of a very specific aspect of feeling that he's talking about here. But that without that contact, with our eyes closed, we don't see sights. We don't experience pleasant, unpleasant, neutral with the sights. We may be asleep and we're not hearing. We're not taking in the sounds. We're not experiencing the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral aspect of sound at that point. And so the Buddha's pointing to that this experience of feeling is not a thing, there doesn't actually have to be an imputation of someone who is feeling. There are just conditions. There's this body that has these sense organs. Light hits the eye. There's contact of that, and then there's a feeling that happens. A feeling arises in dependence on conditions. And so this is a beginning of a pointing of you know, really what the misconception around a sense of self is about. We tend to take these processes of our body and mind that happen. I mean, we're human beings, and we go through the world, and our body is designed to receive experience, our eyes designed to receive sight, our ear to receive sound, our brain and our minds are designed to take that in and recognize them, you know, recognize the sight, recognize the sound. We actually don't need to hypothesize that there's a sense of self there. There are these processes at work that are natural processes that happen. And what happens, what we do is we kind of impute or kind of assume that in order for those processes to work, there has to be somebody in charge of them. There's got to be a sense of self. There's got to be a me there doing that or in charge of it somehow. And the Buddha, you know, begins to kind of pull that apart by looking at the various conditions. Just contact, and then there's feeling. Well, this questioner didn't quite get it from that, because the next question, because the next part of this was, with contact as condition, feeling comes to be. And then he said, with feeling as condition, then the next thing that happens is craving comes to be. That tends to be what happens. There's something pleasant, we like it, we want it. You know, it's like, this is human. We all recognize this. So something's pleasant, we like it, we want it. So the Buddha's pointing to that just being a conditioned process. Almost habitually pleasant tends to arouse the craving for having that pleasant thing. But this questioner didn't quite get it. And his next question was, well, then who craves? And the Buddha again responds, that's not a valid question. He says, you should ask, with what is condition does craving come to be? And he said, feeling. With feeling as condition, craving comes to be. And then with craving as condition, we tend to hold on. We tend to cling. And so he just goes through these processes of what we tend to think of as I'm doing something. We experience something pleasant. Oh, I want that. I'll get that. I'll have that. I'll hold on to that. And the Buddha just describes this as processes unfolding, and the sense that I'm doing it is kind of, well, it's a misinterpretation, but it's also kind of an after the fact thing. It's like something happens in our system, something that's like when we begin to really look at our experience more closely, we can start to see this a little bit. We can see in our experience that something comes up. You know, like a simple example, you're sitting in meditation for a little while, and then, you know, your bladder starts to fill up. That's a process of body. You know, you didn't do that. There were conditions. There was the drinking of water, and that created conditions, but the body processes it. It goes into the bladder. The bladder fills. There's pressure. The body knows that pressure means something and has the kind of urge or intention. The system has the intention to get up to relieve that pressure. And all of that happens. And conventionally we say, I'm going to use the restroom. And conventionally we say that. But we also have that feeling, like I decided to go to the restroom. But sometimes we can start to see that what happened there was that unpleasant pressure, and then this kind of process of an intention arose that's like, take care of that. That actually there are systemic processes that will support taking care of this being without the sense of self. And so, the experience often is something like, well, there's what happens that we don't see is that there's the arising of this intention to do something, and then we kind of give ourselves credit for that intention. I decided to do that. So these two pieces around, you know, kind of orienting to all of our experience through this view of self and the misunderstanding around these conditioned processes being something that they're not. This is one of the key misunderstandings about the sense of self. We tend to attribute a thing to what is actually a process. So I'm going to give a few analogies to and kind of maybe make this feel a little more relatable. So we all know what a river is. There's, you know, we can talk about a river. We've given it a name. We can know where it is. We can talk about, you know, this particular spot on the river and going there and what you might see there. You know, we can talk about getting some water from the river. You know, so we can talk about the river, and it's useful to have that concept. It's useful in our human conventions to have that concept and use it. But when we actually think about what a river is, there's nothing in a river that is stable. When we think about, I mean, especially the water, you know, often we think about the river being the water. But the water is flowing past, and, you know, if you go and grab a bucket of water, it's like you're never going to get the same bucket of water. I mean, the Greek philosopher Heraclitus says, you know, you can never step into the same river twice. There's never anything that's the same about that river. The water is just flowing by. And even what seems to be maybe a little more stable, the riverbank and the bottom of the river, even that is like being washed downstream. And the riverbank gets eroded in storms. You know, the entire even channel of the river can change at times. And so there's nothing that's stable about the river. It's all a process. It's a process. It's not something that we can like pin down and put in a box and say that's the river. That kind of and yet we think about it as a thing. You know, we give it a noun. We call it a noun, a river. We give it a name and it's a noun. And nouns are things, you know, a bell, you know, it's a thing. The river, we give it the name and it's a thing. But when we reflect on it, it's not actually a thing. It's something that is in continual change, continual flow, continual flux. This is more what our experience is. It's just a continual changing flux of body sensations and intentions and thoughts and emotions and feelings that have been conditioned by many things. Conditioned by our history, by our genetics, conditioned by what we've learned in the past. So the conditions have come together to shape how we are, how choices are made. I mean, if we even think about like how we got here, how did you get here today? I mean, you made some decision, or there was a decision that arose at some point to come here, but even that decision has many like threads of conditioning to it. And so the decision to come here today is, you know, it's based on, I don't know, you had time this evening, or there was something that was going on in your day that, you know, created the interest to come, but even that, it's like those things that happened today were based on things that happened yesterday and the day before, and everything that we experienced today is connected to our birth and the parents that we had and the upbringing that we had and what we were taught to believe and understand and know. It's like there is nothing that is not conditioned in our experience. And this conditioned process, we tend to misattribute an I or a me in there. We take it to be self. But it's more like the river. There is something happening there. When we say, you know, the Buddha taught this teaching of not self, you know, sometimes there's this sense or feeling of, am I supposed to stop having a self? Or, you know, it's kind of like it kind of shakes the mind up. You know, it's like the river, there is a river there. There's a process that we call river. It's not the name. It's not a thing. That it is this flux, this flow, this change. And so likewise, there's something going on here. It's not that there's nothing happening here. There's seeing happening, there's hearing happening, there's intentions happening, there's emotions happening. All of that is going on, and there's a lot of familiarity to what's happening. I think this is another place where we tend to kind of feel like, well, it must be me, because I feel kind of the same that I felt yesterday, or I feel these feelings that I felt before. And so there's this kind of sense of a continuity of feelings, and certainly my memories. I can remember what I did yesterday, and I can't remember what you did yesterday. So there's some different process going on here, you know. So there are kind of, we could call each of us our own stream, our own river, our own kind of flow of experience. So there's something happening here. And what the Buddha, one of the pieces the Buddha points to is that whatever that is that's happening, we tend to misattribute that to be a thing. We take it to be something that it's not. We take it to be an I or a me or a mine. So the question from Sunday was, is there a difference between not self as a verb instead of a noun? And I would say that one of the understandings around not self is a beginning of an understanding that what we take to be self is more of a verb, more of a process. So we could think of it as selfing. Selfing is happening. That kind of an activity of selfing is happening. An activity of knowing and feeling and thinking. There's nothing stable anywhere in our experience. And we can start to see this. We can start to recognize this. And so one of the beginning shifts around an understanding of not self is this kind of maybe a reflection or a beginning to recognize that what we take to be something as a thing, something that is stable, solid, when we start looking at it, we see it's not actually stable and solid, but it is more of a process. So we can explore that. And one of the famous teachers, Buddhist teachers, many centuries ago, a Zen teacher, Dogen, said that the way to freedom, basically, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be awakened by all things. And so this could be unpacked in a whole talk, but basically what it's pointing to is that this kind of teaching around selfing, and actually the Buddha pointed to this. He actually, in places, he said, we have this habit of I-making and my-making. It's that, you know, it's like that the making of a sense of self is the process that goes on in the mind. So he's like, we go around I-making and my-making. We don't notice that we're I-making and my-making. We take that I-making and then we own it. And we kind of live in there. And so what this teacher is suggesting is that, you know, rather than having the sense of, oh, am I supposed to believe not self and I'm supposed to like not have a self, it's like, again, there's something happening here. This teaching points to get curious about what it is that you are calling self. get curious about these processes. Get curious to explore this verb of selfing. What is it that you take to be self? What is it that's happening in here that you are calling self? And as you, you know, so even if it feels like there's a noun, an I there that is stable, that could be the first beginning exploration. It's like, well, what do I take to be self? Okay, like right now, what am I taking to be self? Actually, when we start to try to do that, it often gets very nebulous. It's interesting, you know, it's like we try to find out, what is it that I think of, how do I know that I am here? It's kind of more just obvious to us, but when we try to pin it down, it's not pinnable. It doesn't seem to, it's not very amenable to beings to saying, okay, oh, that's what my sense of self is. There are times when we have a very clear sense of, I'm angry or I'm frustrated, and we attach that sense of I to something. But when we look at that, that sense of I'm angry, it's like, well, that's happening for a little while. And it's happened based on some condition. Somebody did something. Somebody did or said something. That arose as a set of conditions. And so that becoming of angry, that angering is a process. And it was based on conditions. And when the conditions changed, that angering will change. And then maybe in a few days, there's going to be a happying happening. And we know this experience that, you know, sometimes we're happy, sometimes we're sad, sometimes we're angry, and yet we seem to, like, you know, have this sense that I am all of these things, or I am the one who experiences all of these things, or something along those lines. And so as we start to get curious about, well, what is it that I'm calling self in this moment? And look at it. We'll start to see that it's not a thing, but it's more variety of things coming together. At one point, I was like, well, what is it that I call self? And times when it feels strong is a good time to begin to be curious about this. Because there's times when it's like, yep, here I am. This one's really familiar. And when I had those kinds of feelings, I'd be like, well, okay, what is familiar here? And it's like, well, there were familiar patterns of contraction in the body that seemed very, you know, they were familiar. I'd experienced them many times. There were familiar thought patterns going on, and also familiar moods that were happening. And so that was one congealing. It's like, okay, well, those are all processes. And then another time, it's like, okay, well, how about now? What am I taking to be self? It's like, well, this is a whole different set of things that I'm taking to be self. These are different feelings in the body and different thoughts and different emotions that are happening. Like, okay, so. And actually, this set of feelings and thoughts and emotions, this sense of self, doesn't seem to have much to do with that sense of self. That's just a bit curious. And so this kind of investigation can help us to start to see that what we call self, if we just get curious about this, you know, what am I taking to be I or me or mine? We'll start to see that there isn't anything that is repeatable. It's a set of familiar things. It's a set of things that we've perhaps experienced before. Similar kinds of things, but they're happening now, and they come and they go, they change. So that question, what am I taking to be self? That's the first question that Dogen suggests, is studying the self. We start to study the self, we see that it's self-thing. We see it as a verb instead of a noun. That's one kind of breaking through to a little bit of the understanding of what the Buddha's pointing to when he speaks of not self. That there isn't a thing here. there are processes at work. And yet just that understanding that what I'm calling self is a verb rather than a noun isn't even quite enough, because we can still own those verbs. We own those verbs, and we see that these things come and go, you know, these habitual states come and go, but there's a way in which we identify with them. You know, we kind of cling onto them, or because they're so familiar, it's almost like we feel like they're hanging out kind of below the surface somewhere, just waiting to come back. And it's almost like we impute a permanence to these states. So before I started meditating, I was pretty miserable. I was not a happy person. And that was a strong identity that I had. And every now and then, something would happen, and I'd be happy. And, you know, I would notice that I was happy. But, you know, what my mind would do with that in that moment was something along the lines of, well, I'm happy now, but I know that what I am is really miserable. You know, kind of imputing or giving more weight to the miserableness than to that happiness. And that's actually a self-reinforcing process at work, because I attribute that identity of miserableness and didn't kind of give an equal, the mind didn't kind of equally balance the happy times with the miserable times. It's like, oh, but what I really am is miserable. You know, having that perspective that miserableness is the condition of my life, when the mind has that kind of a perspective, what does it tend to do? It tends to notice miserableness. It's like that's the orientation. It's like any agenda we have, our minds are going to find things that confirm that agenda. And so that kind of identity, even seeing that it comes and goes, and seeing, oh yeah, these are the conditions that came together for this miserableness, even seeing that it's a kind of a process, there's a way that we can impute a solidity to it, an identification to it, give it more weight, have beliefs that are associated with, yeah, that's me, that's who I am. Another piece that's a kind of an important aspect of study around selfing, see where I am time-wise. One thing the Buddha pointed to, a piece that we tend to strongly identify with. There are many ways he talked about that we identify with various aspects of our experience. He pointed to 20 different ways that we identify with our experience, and I'm not going to go through those. But one key piece that he pointed to is a sense that experience is controllable, or that it should be controllable, and that I should be able to control what I'm feeling, what I'm thinking. And there is a way that there are processes that can make decisions. There's an agency that's a part of this human system that, for instance, given that full bladder, that agency, a decision can be made, that agency can make a decision to get up and use the restroom. There's not necessarily an I there. There's not, you know, it's just, this is the process of the way our system kind of takes care of us. Through this kind of choosing, you know, kind of there's a choice that is made. It is not that choices are not made, but we tend to, a big place of identification is around choice making. This feeling of I'm the one in control, or I should be the one in control. And the Buddha pointed to, you know, just kind of reflecting. You know, he took his followers on a thought experiment about our human experience. And he said, the body is not self. That's where he started. He said, the body's not self. If the body were self, it would be possible to say, may my body be like this. May my body not be like this. Now, basically, one of the ways in which people imputed a sense of self, he was kind of undermining or pointing to a particular way that we tend to impute a sense of self. It's like, I am in control. I can decide what to do. I can decide what not to do. And he went through all the aspects of our experience and said, okay, so body, can you say, may my body be like this? You know, break your leg. You can't just say, oh, may I not have a broken leg. There's a healing process that will happen, but it's not within our conscious choice to make our bodies be the way we'd like them to be in the moment. And the Buddha says that that's actually evidence for this understanding of not self. So this kind of experience happens to us all the time, where we see, oh, I don't have control over that. But rather than taking that as a little bit of a, oh, that's what the Buddha was pointing to. That's a piece of what the Buddha was pointing to around not self. We take it personally and feel like we've done something wrong or not figured something out. So an example of this that happens regularly in meditation. So we sit down to meditate. We have the intention. So the intention in sitting down to meditate is to try to stay present. What happens? The mind wanders. So the mind wanders. Did you decide to have the mind wander? No, not usually. I mean, sometimes we can try to have the mind wander, but if I say right now, don't be present, stop being mindful, sometimes that's not so easy to do. So this wandering off happens because of conditions. It's not something I chose to do. And then, a few minutes later, the mindfulness returns. There's a sense of, I'm back. Did you make that one happen? No. Again, these things that happen all the time. It's like the Buddha pointed to for that particular one. We could reframe what he said around the body, and he went through it with respect to our mental activities as well. Mindfulness is not self. If mindfulness were self, it would be possible to say of mindfulness, may mindfulness be like this. May mindfulness not be like this. But mindfulness is not self, so it's not possible to say that. And so this simple experience of sitting down to meditate, seeing the mind wander, noticing it come back, is a pointer to this understanding of not self. But what do we do with that? We usually blame ourselves for not being able to stay present. We own the mindfulness. We feel like we should be able to own it and control it and do it and make it be what we want it to be. And that's not possible. And we feel like, I'm not a good meditator. I've got to, everybody else can do this. I can't do this. Again, coming back to those thoughts of me. As opposed to kind of allowing one of the things I think the Buddha points to here is like, have some amazement around this process of the human body that takes care of itself, does things, feels things, chooses things, decides things, allows this organism to navigate the world This understanding or this teaching, this like these, there's so many things that happen in our day that are evidence for this truth that the Buddha is pointing to. But instead of receiving it as a pointing to truth, we feel like we've done something wrong. So this exploration around controllability, the next time it feels for you like, I can't do this or I can't make this be under my control. Maybe you could have the thought come in, oh, because it's not self. Because this is nature. This is the nature of things. And yet there's this paradox around this. Again, you know, it's like our system is so complex. So, you know, hearing that, okay, mindfulness is not self. We can't make mindfulness be this way or that way. What the mind might do with that is, well, what's the point then? Why should I even bother to try if it's not self? If I don't have control over it, why should I bother to try? Well, there's this paradoxical feedback loop that intention to engage, hearing something, you know, like I heard many years ago, this is useful. This practice is useful. And, you know, I was in a state of real misery, and somebody pointed me to something, somebody brought in, said, this has helped me be less miserable. It's like hearing that kind of sparked my interest. It's like, okay, let's try it. So there's it's like, it's not me that decided to try it. There were conditions that came together. My friend pointing this out to me, the miserableness that I was experiencing, the sense of I've tried everything I could think of. You know, the sense of I'd tried to find my way to happiness. And here's something a friend is telling me. This supported them. That created some interest. It's like, well, let's see what happens. So there were choices that were made. But there was not a self that made those choices. There were the processes unfolding. So again, doesn't quite go all the way in, and that's okay. Just maybe pieces of this will resonate. But I think what's most curious or interesting that we can begin to do is begin to be curious about self as a verb. Be curious about what is it that I take to be self? And what's actually going on there? So sometimes the sense of self feels really clear. Certain kind of emotions or mind states, it's like there's this congealing of a sense of, this one's really familiar. Up at Spirit Rock, they have these turkeys, that's kind of the feeling, you know, that at certain times of the year, the male turkeys kind of go, they puff out, and they really inhabit their birdness. They're trying to get the female birds interested. And so there's this kind of, you know, this inhabiting of that. There's a puffing that happens. That kind of puffing feeling can be a kind of a signal or a sign, okay, that's a useful one to look at, the sense of, you know, self-righteousness can be that kind of a feeling. Certain identities around strong emotions where they're very familiar. So the miserableness for me, or self-hatred was a big one, that there was a strong identity around self-hatred. So I spent a lot of time looking at that pattern and beginning to recognize that actually it might be useful to tell a little of this story, because it does kind of demonstrate a little bit about how the seeing of this as a process was so freeing for the mind. So the self-hatred was something, you know, it's a very deep, old process connected with a lot of history, and yet I was not so aware of it until I started meditating. I had an image of myself as being very competent, very skilled, could do what I wanted to do. And then when I started meditating, I started hearing all these thoughts in my mind, like, you're no good, you're a failure, you can't do things right, you know, you just can't do anything right. So there was this real pattern of self-hatred that really shocked me in some ways. And so I spent quite a bit of time exploring it, getting it to know it, and it feels really unpleasant. It's a very painful state to have that kind of a sense of negative aversion, hatred turned back to the being itself. And so it was hard to watch. It was hard to be with. At times I had to not be with it. I had to practice with, you know, setting it aside and, you know, exploring, can I find some compassion here? Can I, just not let that be where I'm focusing right now? So many, many strategies that I worked with in exploring this pattern over several years. And one long retreat that I went to, this pattern became like the main pattern that was happening on the retreat. And I was really disappointed because I thought, you know, it was kind of like, okay, I guess I'm not going to get enlightened this time. This is going to be, okay, this is my self-hatred retreat. But actually, that was the point at which the retreat began to shift. When I finally kind of surrendered, and it's like, instead of fighting through it, it's like, well, this is what's happening, so I'm going to just be with it. I'm going to see what I can learn about it, what I can watch, what I can understand. And so, I was just watching, and I had heard this teaching from Joseph Goldstein in the hall about when there's something really, really sticky, and this was pretty sticky, the self-hatred was a pretty sticky emotion. He said, sometimes it's helpful to notice when there's the unpleasantness happening and notice, you know, that there's something happening right before the unpleasantness. There's something that has arisen that is unpleasant. The self-hatred was very unpleasant, but I hadn't been noticing, you know, kind of what was it that was coming that the mind was kind of attributing to be unpleasant. And so started looking at that, just like, okay, well, there's this unpleasantness. What's here? What's here? What's here? And at some point in that process, the mind noticed that there was just a thought arising in the mind, something like, you're a failure. You can't do this. So a thought arising in the mind. And then there was a kind of a jumping on that thought and believing it. And in that moment of seeing that, so that the practice was strong enough that the mind could see, there had been a thought that arose, and then the mind kind of like, yep, that's true. Kind of, that's what the mind did in that moment. And it saw that happening, and the next moment the mind realized, that whole thing is just the mind making this up. This is just a thought in the mind. This has no reality. It's just the mind thinking this thing. And so the mind recognizing this, essentially, this is a conditioned arising. This is arising based on this thought and this believing of this thought. And so in that moment, seeing that, right in that moment, the self-hatred just kind of vanished for that moment. And there was just, you know, real deep happiness in the mind, an ease, and an ease in the mind, just in a split second from self-hatred to bliss, just a shift like that. The next thought gave me a smile, which was something like, never again will I feel self-hatred. And the mind was wise enough to recognize, no, that's probably not true. Because there was an understanding in that moment, the seeing of this, the understanding of this, is also conditions that are happening right now. This is also an understanding that's in this moment. And so there was then the kind of bliss kind of more neutralized, and it was just more like just balance. That understanding, though, did have a very powerful effect on that whole pattern of self-hatred, because essentially what it did, it did not stop, and still I do see these thoughts from time to time, but what it did seem to undermine is the way in which the mind believed those thoughts, the way in which it kind of like said, yep, that's true. That was the piece that kind of was cut, was kind of really seen through. It's like, yeah, these are just thoughts arising. They're not something that need to be believed. And so the curiosity about this pattern, this very sticky pattern, which was very, very identified with, very much who I felt I was, the willingness to see it as a process, the watching of that, the mind began to understand something different about it. This is just causes and conditions. This self-hatred comes up in certain conditions. And it's really the believing of it that brings the feeling of the pain with it. And so all the suffering around the self-hatred came because I believed those thoughts. Now, I don't have to go around now saying, oh, there's a thought, oh, I better not believe that. The believing just seems to be not happening so much anymore. So this kind of exploration, so whatever feels, for me, this was probably one of the stickiest patterns that I had, the self-hatred. And the willingness to watch it, to be curious about it. What's going on there? Seeing it as a process, seeing it as conditioned, allowed not me to say, I'm going to get rid of this. I mean, self-hatred is not self. One cannot say of self-hatred, may self-hatred be thus or not thus. And yet, the practice of curiosity about what is this, the mind begins to seeing that these are just conditions. Essentially, what I'd say is that the mind seeing that the condition of believing the self-hatred created so much suffering, and the mind seeing that the mind was doing that believing, the mind began to recognize. Essentially, the mind begins to see that the suffering that we're experiencing that can be released, at least the suffering that we're experiencing that can be released, is created by an internal process in the mind. And when the mind understands its own participation in those processes, we're fortunate that we have a system that wants to move in the direction of well-being. And so as the mind sees its own participation in these patterns and habits of suffering through identification, through not understanding, the mind begins to recalibrate, reorient, let go of some of these things. And that was my experience around the believing. It's like the mind began to stop believing those thoughts. And I didn't have to say, oh, don't believe those thoughts. It just was what unfolded because the mind saw that process. Because the mindfulness allowed the seeing of that process. So the curiosity of the verb nature of our sense of self. And then even seeing that verb nature, noticing where there's believing of that verb. You know, so for me, that seeing of the selfing around self-hatred, understanding that was coming and going, but the believing process, that's another piece of the kind of the puzzle in terms of more deeply understanding the teaching of not-self. We could still believe that these verbs are who we are. And they are just processes at work. So, I'm sorry there's not time for questions. But it's time to stop. So, thank you. And I'm happy to stay for a couple minutes if somebody has something they want to ask just privately. So, thank you.